Hello, and thank you for listening to Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig Faust with Life Care Counseling, and here with me today is Nicole Oliver with Integrative Neuro Counseling. Nicole, hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you today, Craig?
Oh, not too bad. So I know that you're particularly excited, just as I am. We are going to be talking about the stress response today, which I know is probably like one of my top 10 favorite things to talk about. It may even be like one of your top five things to talk about.
Definitely.
So first things first, whenever we talk about the stress response, I think almost the fundamental things to talk about is most every animal, or at least every mammal, has a stress response. And we as human beings, our stress response is very much developed over time to where most everyone has experienced their stress response going off. And in our society today, I think a lot of us actually experience an overactive stress response. So we'll not only talk about how the stress response activates, how you calm, or how the stress response then kind of regulates and how it goes back to normal or baseline. But then we'll also kind of talk about trends that end up making people's stress response more active or maybe even less active. So we got a lot to talk about today, and I know that we're really excited to do that. So first things first, Nicole, can you just tell us a little bit about whenever the stress response gets started up, just kind of what's going on that would even kick something like this off?
Yeah, so if I could just start with a little basis, just kind of how my mind works is the autonomic nervous system is what we're talking about. So autonomic, we want to think of it being automatic.
Okay.
So when we're out and about in the world, let's say we're driving in a car and someone slams on the brakes, then we slam on the brakes. You can feel that stress response. You can feel it down your throat, down your chest, and your feet. You can kind of feel shaky. You kind of feel like, oh, something almost happened. That's that stress response. That's that sympathetic nervous system. That's what we call it. And the importance of that is just to say that's the fight, flight, or freeze.
Okay.
That's that beginning, you know, when it kicks on.
I think that's probably what most people know it by, too, is that fight, flight, or freeze response, too. I always love using cars as examples because it's such an easy thing. So for you, an example, whenever you see the car stopping, this response may turn on because you're going to hit the car unless something happens. So in this case, the stress response actually helps you to react to whatever's going on. So that's actually a pretty normal thing that ends up happening. I wonder, can you tell me what it looks like whenever maybe it looks, that response may look a little more abnormal?
Absolutely. So let's start with maybe like a social anxiety kind of abnormality. Maybe someone is socially anxious around others. They start anticipating, they start thinking about it. So their body's not worked up yet. It's just the thoughts of it. So they might feel a little bit of anxiety. Then they go into the social setting, and then they can start seeing people as they walk into a room. Their hands are clammy. Their heart starts palpating. It starts becoming overwhelming. They can't speak. They can't talk. They can't engage. That's when they're in that sympathetic nervous system. And it does that over a period of time, and it doesn't stop. So that becomes an automatic reaction for them. And so that's a little bit worse for people with the social anxiety.
Yeah, so it's almost like your body and brain, they learn and they kind of try to anticipate things. So I think that's one of the things that's important. So you said something earlier, the sympathetic nervous system. I think for me, the easiest way that I remember that is sympathetic equals stress, right? So that whenever we start to get stress, our stress response activates, we go into a sympathetic nervous system. So if we can kind of even just rewind a little bit and going back to some of these examples, the thing that kicks off our stress response is whenever we perceive any type of threat. So the threat does not always even have to be a real threat. So this is the example that I like to tell my clients the most. And I don't know how you'll feel about this, Nicole, so you have to let me know.
Okay.
So let's say that I'm someone that takes great pride in what I wear and the outfits that I choose and the color coordination, which anybody that knows me would know that this is not true. But let's pretend for a second that I am. Right. And let's say that we're sitting here and Nicole kind of looks over at me after we're not recording and she goes, you know, Craig, the sandals that you wore here today, I mean, they just look really awful with that outfit. Right. Which is, that's something that Nicole would never say. But let's just say she did. And I'm like, man, I really take great pride in my outfit, my shoes. I really love these sandals. Right. So even though Nicole did not directly threaten me, right? It's not like because I chose these sandals to wear that that's going to result in me, you know, dying because someone said that I made some type of fashion blunder. But my body and brain, specifically my brain in this case, because I take great pride in what I wear, it could perceive it as a threat, right? It's a threat to like my character, mm-hmm. right? So this is a way that we as humans, we're really smart compared to other animals. And that being said, because we're so smart, sometimes we create problems for ourselves. So this is a great situation where I can create a problem for myself, whereas I take great pride in the outfits that I wear and that I actually become offended. When I become offended by this, this threat of character part shows up and my stress response will actually activate with that. Right. So I may actually start to get really flustered or, I may start to yell or anything like that or lash back, or I'm going to make some type of comment about, her outfit or anything like that. Those would all be examples of what is happening whenever my stress response is coming up because of that perceived threat, even though there is actually no threat. And kind of even go into your social anxiety scenario, like most people, I think they got a certain fear whenever they're talking to people or in front of a crowd or anything like that. And that being said, whenever you're out in front of that crowd and your stress response is activated, again, you're not in a situation where if you totally bomb this speech that you're actually in a life-threatening situation. However, in those moments, your stress response is kind of making it feel like that. And for those of you that suffer from this particular type of thing, it really does feel like, hey, if I don't make this, my whole life is going to be ruined. Yeah. And that makes sense because that's kind of what, that's the way your body's responding. That's what your brain is kind of telling you in those moments, right? It's that same response that's going to happen if you're to rewind like, 1,000, 2,000 years ago or whatever, where early humans would be attacked by some type of predator or anything like that. It's the same type of response that's happening, even though it's just a comment about the shoes or even though it's just a speech that you're giving.
Absolutely. I think that's so important. And like you said, it could be something as simple as that. It's a threat response that's perceived. Mm-hmm. So how many times a day are we having this from the time we leave our house in the morning, talk to our spouses, our children, we go to work, we walk into the office, how many events are happening? And this is compounding through the day, the different stressors or those stress responses. And I think that's important when you look at it as cumulative. So that's really what's happening more when you look at somebody with PTSD, for example, which is the highest form of anxiety. Mm-hmm. They've been in these stress response states for years or decades, for long periods of time, where they can't even turn that off. That's happening. The pupils are dilating, so they're scanning. They become very hypervigilant. Their ears, they're sensitive to sound and will perceive negativity when it's not there.
Oh, yeah. And we'll talk more about some of these states, like especially like PTSD, that's very, severe. Very much an overactive stress response. Yes. And we'll get to some of those things. So like whenever we perceive this type of threat, our brain kind of gets better and better at perceiving threats, right? Because we as human beings, we like to be prepared for things, mm-hmm. right? So if Nicole makes a comment about I'm gonna call them slippers, my sandals, right? And I might be, the rest of that day, I may be kind of looking, all right, is someone looking towards my sandals? Or I may be a little more sensitive to about it or anything like that. Like, that's very normal for our brain to do different things like that. So the next thing after we perceive a threat, the next thing that happens is that unconsciously, one of the things that will actually happen is our muscles will start to tighten in our core. So I would say that this is where I'm going to veer a little bit from kind of like more of the scientific basis on this. And what I'm saying is, as I'm describing this to you, I'm not saying that it's not based in science. What I'm saying is, so like your core muscles tighten, but for some people, it doesn't stop at the core muscles, right? So like for me, for instance, whenever I start to go into the stress response, if I'm really paying attention to it, not only will my core muscles tighten up, but actually like my shoulders were tighten up too, which is it's not always the same. And sometimes for people, other parts of their body may tense up too, just kind of depending on what it is. So I say the core muscles because that's traditionally what automatically does it. But the core muscles are important because whenever those core muscles tense up, they pinch this nerve called the vagus nerve, which I think that we actually talked about on our first episode. And I think that you probably know a little more about the vagus nerve than I do. Can you talk to us a little bit about
absolutely, that? Craig. I'm very excited about the vagus nerve. So polyvagal theory was designed by Dr. Porges, and I think it's very helpful. And to put it in common terms, it's that fight, flight, and freeze. That is activated in this vagus nerve. So again, it's the 10th cranial nerve right here in front of the ear. It goes down through the throat into the chest, down between your ribs, kind of feels like someone punches you in the gut when you feel sick, down into the mesenteric area of the bowel. And what happens is the front of the vagus nerve can be triggered with these chemical cocktails that make us hyperreactive.
Mm-hmm.
The back side of that is called dorsal. So he calls it dorsal vagal dominance. When that is triggered, that's when you're in that freeze state. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not moving. Your muscles are tense. Your breathing becomes very, very slow, and then your heart rate is beating up, and you're just ready for action. So if you saw a tiger, for example, like we talked in last episode, you'd be ready to act without thought.
Yeah.
So that's the benefit of this vagus nerve, this response.
One of the, I don't remember if we mentioned this in that episode. If not, or if we did, this is kind of a rehashing of it, right? If you may not be familiar with what a freeze response looks like, then if you've ever watched National Geographic, where a predator is pouncing on some type of prey or anything like that, and you see the prey kind of like play dead or something like that, that would be a good example of, you know, going into that freeze response to try to conserve energy until you have the opportunity usually to flee.
Right.
So whenever we go into this, and this vagus nerve, it's being activated, it's being kind of like pinched by these muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever it's being pinched, that's really whenever a lot of this stuff turns on. And it happens so quickly that even though, like, I could be here and I could snap my finger, it actually happens faster than that. And because it's part of our survival, right? So there are kind of two components that end up happening, right? And whenever this vagus nerve gets activated, we get this cocktail of chemicals that goes into our bloodstream. We'll kind of talk more about those. But the probably key ones to talk about is going to be adrenaline and cortisol are the key ones to talk about. So adrenaline, as most of you may know or you've experienced, or I'd hope that most of you would experience this. So adrenaline is a stimulant, right? So what that means is that whenever your body gets stimulated, the heart will start to beat faster, blood pressure will go up, you'll start to breathe heavier, you might start to sweat. There's a whole host of things that end up happening as your body is preparing itself, in this case, to survive, right? And whenever that adrenaline's taking place, this is all just kind of physical signs of what's going on in the body. So if we kind of even just rewind a little bit, these muscles that are tightening that pinch this vagus nerve, that is happening unconsciously. So a lot of times we are not even aware of this happening. Now, you can work really hard to become more and more aware of that stuff and kind of take notice of it earlier and earlier. It's usually really difficult. And for most people, it's also really hard to be able to sense whenever different muscles in our core are activated, because most of us aren't like professional athletes, or we aren't like trained in the military or something like that to become hyper aware of muscle tension in our body or anything like that. Unless I don't know if there's any other occupations where they might be really good at sensing stuff like that.
I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough one. And again, I think it's because it's in that autonomic nervous system. It's automatic, and that's what it's designed for. So
yeah,
I think that's a great point.
Yeah, it's really hard
when it hits you.
Yeah, so I think that whenever people are in their stress response, one of the first physical symptoms that I think most people start to notice is whenever it feels like they get the surge of energy and they feel like they're breathing heavier.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me, like I said, I kind of notice when my shoulders tense up. But I think the first thing that most people start to notice is they start to get warmer. The body temperature starts to go up. And of course, it starts to go up because blood pressure is going up. Your body's expending energy to kind of prepare it.
Right.
So you might start sweating or anything like that. Your hands might get clammy or anything to kind of help you prepare. So that's kind of what happens on the physical side of things. Or did I miss anything on the physical side of things?
No, I think that's so good. And I think, you know, while we are afraid of these things, or uncomfortable, I should say, they're really quite helpful. I think also looking at them as a positive, if we can learn to bring them in regulation. regulation when we get to the other side later with the parasympathetic, we can see how we can learn to regulate that with a baseline later with some of the tools we're going to give.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's kind of talk a little bit about what happens in the brain.
In the brain, right?
Because
okay.
that's kind of more of a fun area,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, kind of give me an idea from like your experience. What's kind of the first thing that starts to happen, you know, in our upstairs?
So the first thing that I think is happening is the amygdala is taking an intention, like we talked about last time. And mm-hmm. so, as it's taking an intention, it's relaying information to the memory part of the bank from previous experience in the hippocampus. Or scanning our senses in that moment. Mm-hmm. So those two are relaying, and then it's sending information to our adrenal glands right mm-hmm. above the kidneys. That's what's pumping out the adrenal to send mm-hmm. the message. And what's interesting about this system is it's very quick. It's faster than the snapping of a finger, like you said. It's within thousands of milliseconds that's happening, and it's automatic. Mm-hmm. And that's to keep us alive. So it's one line. It's not firing two neurons. It's on that smooth tissue. So that's why it's affecting the sweat glands, the heart, the beating, all of these pieces. Yeah. So it's huge. It's important.
Well, and just kind of a reminder too. So like if for some reason you're coming, you didn't listen to the first episode or anything. So the amygdala, that's the part of our brain that is really governing our fear. It kind of stores different memories and stuff like that. So it helps us to know what's a threat and what's not. It helps to kind of like assess those different types of things. And it stores memories that are very much like traumatic or very difficult. It is very, very potent. So this is a very important part of our brain. And whenever that thing kind of starts to take over, oh man, it does some things.
It does.
And I think that our first episode, you gave kind of a good picture of like if you were to kind of picture your brain where you take your thumb and you kind of, you know, fold it over like you're kind of showing like four, and then you wrap your fingers around it, right? And you kind of look at your brain that way, whereas the outer part of your hand is the main meat of the brain, and then the inner part is some like the inner structures, and then your wrist is kind of starting into that lower structure of your brain into your spinal column. The lower structure of your brain that is a lot of times it's called like the reptilian part of our brain. This is the kind of part that is really, really active, and it's really kind of fair game during this time. Whereas some of the other parts of our brain, like where we get more to like the midbrain or getting more even to like the prefrontal cortex or anything like that, resources are really being taken away from those areas. And they are being focused on these more primitive areas, these more survival-oriented areas. So I think that that's something that's really important. So if I'm standing up and I'm trying to give a speech, well, guess what? My ability to speak and articulate what I'm saying, those types of functions in my brain, they are housed in the prefrontal cortex, which is having resources taken away from it. So it becomes hard to speak, it becomes hard to articulate, it becomes hard to interpret emotions, it becomes hard to process your own emotions or understand them, it becomes hard to problem solve, it's hard to think about the future, hard to write, and hard to have artistic talent or creativity. I don't know, are there other things you can think of that...
No, it takes away everything but basic functioning of survival. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And I love Dan Siegel. That's kind of what he did with where the hand is and the limbic system versus the reptilian versus mm-hmm. the prefrontal cortex. He simplifies it with upstairs brain as our thinking and downstairs brain. So anytime we're in that downstairs brain, we are not our best selves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, if I'm in a life or death situation, I don't need to be thinking a lot.
That's right. Right. So we want to thank it for that. That's a lot of times with trauma patients, that's an important piece. Mm-hmm. People are afraid of these body systems and these feelings and sensations. That's really what creates more and more of the fear and that feedback loop when you're talking about that part of the brain as well.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Feedback loop, or I want to get to that actually.
Okay. Okay.
I wanted to jump the gun there for a second.
Yeah.
So let's say that this stress response, I kind of want to separate some things for a second. So I call things a stress response, and then there's kind of like the anxiety response. So I kind of separate those, whereas like the anxiety is more what's happening in the brain, and stress is more what's happening in the body. I don't know if that kind of fits your understanding of things, or if that kind of fits or does that terminology fit with you?
I think it does. I think, you know, anxiety is a normal part of life. And like you said, that's more the stress response. Where it becomes more anxiety in the brain, where the structures start to change or the neurochemicals become increased, it's where that stress response is either induced more often than it should be because it's a perception of it, or they're in an actual, actual state of life-threatening, you know, battered women or veterans or police officers, people like that, that do have the more severe stress responses of that.
Yeah, so whenever, going back to that example where we're driving the car, someone stops short in front of us, we slam on the brakes, right? Our stress response activates, we slam on the brakes because we perceive that that's a threat. We don't want to run into the back of this person in front of us. And after that happens, and let's say that we get home, all right, we are past the threat, right? So the amygdala, who's still scanning for any threats or anything, it's finally like, all right, I don't see any threats, right? So your body can finally start to calm down. It can finally start to like downshift or whatever you may want to call it. It can finally start to regulate, or a lot of people call it down regulating or anything like that. So your body can start to calm down and try to return to more normal functioning during this time. So kind of talk us through that. Or what
that would be engaging that parasympathetic nervous system. And sometimes they call it rest and digest. So that's kind of helpful. When you're in that, you know, stress response, you're not digesting food because it's restricted, like we talked about. You're not able to do, you know, reproductive things, all these other things that we would be doing if we're not stressed out. So the parasympathetic is this calm state. The amygdala is taking in the data and saying, okay, we're okay now. We're at home. Everything's calm. The stress is gone. And the body system goes back to homeostasis, or that natural place of being. So I think how that's happening is the vagus nerve is getting relayed information through the amygdala, and then the adrenal glands start to calm down, and then we get either oxytocin starts to come. There are a couple different chemicals that come down to bring it down. Even the cortisol is up high, and then it starts to come down, and that also brings down the adrenal glands.
Muscles loosen up, so it's taking pressure off
ATP
that vagus
is happening.
Nerve.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool things that happen.
Yeah, a lot of cool things.
I think that all of us kind of notice that, like, whenever, I think the best sign of this is whenever you can finally, after going through a stress response, just take a big sigh where you're like, right? If any of you guys have children, right? I have at the time of this recording, I have a 10-month-old, right? So, like, whenever he really flips out, whenever we're putting him to bed, you can tell whenever his stress response is finally over. Or it's finally in the place where he's starting to relax, whenever he just does that big sigh before his whole body starts to go limp, right? And it's just like that for us adults too, right? Whenever we're going to that stress response and finally we're able to downregulate, then all of a sudden there's whole muscle groups will just relax and the tension will go out of them. And that's kind of when we know that, all right, now we're in that relaxed state.
Yeah, it's like a release almost, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's like your muscles release. I love that you said the breath. I mean, everybody can relate to, whew, that was a close one. You know, even in the car, even after that moment, just feeling that release. It feels calming. You can feel the calm almost come over where they're burning or they're trickling down your arms or your legs or the cool tension. Feels warm and soft at that point. Yeah. Limp.
So there's a couple things that you said that I want to kind of point back to real quick. So whenever we're in the sympathetic nervous system, one of the things that's turned off is our digestion, right? So this is such a key thing because if we're in the fight of our life, we don't need to digest food, right? So people that are stuck in their stress response consistently, their body is not digesting food. And if food stays in your digestive tract for such a long time, it will actually get converted right to fat. So this is really important because here in America, a lot of us like struggle with weight and regulating our weight or anything like that. Well, one of the things is if you're stressed out all the time, then with your digestive system being turned off all the time, even if you're not eating very much, it becomes really hard to lose weight because the food in your body is being converted straight into fat, which is a harder resource for your body to break down to get glucose to start to run your body or anything like that. Which it does that for a specific reason because it's a survival response,
right?
It's actually a response that takes place whenever you aren't consuming enough calories as well. So I want to make special mention towards that because I think that I think it's something that gets overlooked a lot. Like whenever we can kind of consider stress, like people say like, oh, like whenever you stress eat, or like you might gain weight. But that's actually one of the big functions of weight gain with people that have a lot of stress.
Absolutely.
One of the other things that I want to be able to kind of point towards is whenever our body is really kind of downshifting and starting to calm down, there is another system that is being activated, and that's called our endocannabinoid system. So I want to mention that because I have some of these episodes that I've been talking about addiction and everything, and that's going to come into play, and I'll bring it up again. So the endocannabinoid system is a system that gets activated that helps us calm down as well. So I just want to make special mention towards that. So there are a lot of systems that are activated in order not only to amp us up, but I think even more systems get activated to actually calm us back down, because that's even more of an important time where we're trying to make sure that everything is safe and everything is okay. And really, for our body in those moments, whenever we finally get to that calm state, one of the things that happens for most people, if you have a really stressful day or anything, you kind of have to get into a calm state before you can even go to sleep. So like, let's say that someone has a traumatic experience. A lot of times for us as therapists, we'll try to assess, all right, when did you notice that the threat passed? And for many people, they cannot tell. So then it's like, all right, well, when did you go to sleep next, right? Because that's, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, your body's like, okay, it's safe enough to, like, we need to go to bed.
Right.
Right. So that being said, you may be like, well, shoot, I don't know whenever I have this big sigh or anything like that that you're talking about. And you may not notice it. It may just be like whenever you go to sleep and your body is kind of relaxing, you may not necessarily get that whole body relief or experience. Because it doesn't happen until that point. So right. I just want to point that out because sometimes people don't recognize
that.
Yeah,
and I think that's exactly what happens with clients that I work with PTSD in particular. That stress response is never coming down. Not only are they having that stress response activated all the time, it barely comes down. So they're not able to sleep, or they're sleeping mm-hmm. in small amounts of time. It's the amygdala is affecting mm-hmm. that rhythm of their circadian rhythm of their sleep and their brain waves and all that constriction in the body as well. It's mm-hmm. affecting that in every category.
Like whenever they're able to sleep, and like people naturally wake up a little bit throughout the night, so right. all of a sudden that slight shift can really jar you awake or mm-hmm. anything like that.
Startle reflex.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. We'll have to talk about like night terrors and stuff like that at some point. That'll be an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we kind of talked about how the stress response activates and how it starts to go down, let's talk about these feedback loops that we get into, because I think that's really important. So as we kind of talked about during our very first podcast episode, our brain will customize itself. I think you always say, like what fires together, wires together.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? It happens in this case too, just like Nicole was saying earlier, where our brain, whenever we sense some type of threat or anything, if it's a threat that shows up more and more often, our brain will get better and better at sensing that this is a threat. It'll go in the stress response easier, more often, and in a more, I don't want to say, in a more noticeable way for you, I think, whereas it becomes more of a generalized thing.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like how that person responds. You know, you hear it from a spouse, well, she always does that. You'll start mm-hmm. hearing, she seems to always perceive I'm attacking her when I'm smiling and coming at her in a pleasant way. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot with my PTSD clients, where maybe a normal anxiety client wouldn't have that at that level or that often, that frequent.
Yeah, I think that maybe even another example that may kind of paint this picture is, like, let's say that you're in a car and you get into a car accident, and it's something that's really terrifying for you, so that every time that you get into a car, it's scary, right? Shoot, some people haven't even been in a big car accident. Cars are still scary.
Mm-hmm.
And so that case, every time that you're in the car and something scary happens, you almost get into an accident, your brain may fire and wire in such a way that now every time that you get into a car, you're kind of on high alert, or you're kind of in that stress response in order to try to keep yourself safe. And That would be a normal interaction of how the brain will kind of up the threat level each time, so that now every time that you get into a car, it's really easy for you to get triggered and go into the stress response. So that would be kind of like a normal developmental thing. Now, is that like a healthy thing? Not really, but at the same time, that's a normal progression of something like that, and kind of like a more general way that more people may actually be aware of.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's an evolutionary advantage when you mm-hmm. think of threats, and especially if you're passing it on to our offspring. We're not thinking about that. So I have a lot of clients, that young girls coming in with anxiety, for example. Well, how did this develop? Well, one, the little girl's had a couple bad experiences, not too many yet, but mother's modeling that behavior in the car as she's learning to drive. And so then you'll start seeing she's having it. Right? So the amygdala is taking in modeling, for one, with mirror neurons. Mm-hmm. Then she's taking it in her own. So it's like twofold. Both systems are activated at the same time.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And especially with kids, they are borrowing their parents' nervous system. So their brain is starting to wire in a way that's similar to their parents. Mm-hmm. But not only that, then you got the genetic component for a lot of this. And so they're already passed down certain genes that make it easy for them to go into these certain stress response. So an example of this is, if you come from parents that are really anxious or stressed out people, you are more genetically predispositioned to actually go into a stress response and have more anxiety related responses to those similar type of triggers. Not only because you've witnessed that, but also because genetically you're just more prone to it. Now, does that mean that it has to be like that for you all the time? No, just like our first episode we talked about with epigenetics, like you do have some ability to customize that and everything. Mm-hmm. But these type of things can be passed down over generations, and it is a survival mechanism, just like you're Absolutely. Talking about. I think that's so cool to actually think about, is that we always think about it. I think a lot of times we think about it in the negative, right? Oh, I can't be stressed out because I don't want my kids to be stressed out all mm-hmm. the time. Well, at the same time, you're passing on key informational things to your child to try to help them survive. I mean, mm-hmm. that is a really, really important thing, right? We know to be wary of some predators, even whenever, you know, we start to grow like 2, 3, 4 years old or anything. Mm-hmm. Because our parents have passed down that information and we've become developed enough to recognize that, and we have categories for those types of things.
Right.
That's really great for our survival.
It really is. And I think it's not the fact that we have these responses, is that we stay in the stress response. I think being able to turn on that, you know, parasympathetic and learn to self-soothe, learn to calm. I think of like a, you know, a lighting system, the old kind where, you know, kind of turn it up and down.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of what I do with my clients.
Switches.
Yeah, like a dimmer. Yeah. And just kind of down-regulate or downshift. We talk about, you know, kind of regulating those emotions, to learn to turn that off. Even as a baseline, when you're not anxious, to learn to practice kind of calming and breath and soothing, some of those things, to start to treat that nervous system, if you do have a predisposition to it, to just have the, first of all, the awareness of what's happening reduces the fear in itself. That's a part of that feedback loop too. As soon as you feel the fear, you have the thought, then it activates that stress response again.
Yeah, so I want to even talk about that feedback loop, right? So I think this is such an interesting thing. So usually whenever we start to develop anxiety, I think the easiest way that most people can identify that their anxiety is like, is that whenever it starts up and their stress response activates, what's kind of happens in our head is we start to think about all these possibilities, right? So thoughts usually start to speed up, which makes sense, because as our body is stimulated, we're getting more blood flow to different areas of the brain. Guess what happens when more blood flow happens? You get more resources to the brain. So more resources equals more thought production can happen, right? So whenever we start to think more about all these different possibilities, it's easy to think about how everything can go wrong, right? Which then your amygdala is like, oh crap, that could go wrong too. I better prepare for that. So then it amps you up even more. Then it's like, oh, more thought production. Oh, this can this and this and this could go wrong. So amps up even more. And it becomes this really powerful feedback loop, where those of us that may suffer from anxiety, it's really hard to come down from, because we kind of become convinced in some ways that everything or anything or anyone can be a threat to us.
Absolutely. You know, I talk to my clients and I call it catastrophizing because that's that worst case scenario, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of how it is. You know, I call it catastrophizing. And, you know, it, like, again, with this feedback loop, I think of like Highway 70 for local people here in St. Louis. It's a circular motion. Mm-hmm. The catastrophe thoughts start going automatically without our permission. They just start going because now the amygdala is seeking different things. So what I teach them to do is to stop, do inquiry with that part of the anxiety and kind of jump on page extension or Highway 40 with thinking what else is possible that's less than the worst case scenario, because mm-hmm. that's more likely. So that's the cognitive component of it. But always regulating that body is going to be helpful, right? That has to first when you think of order of operations.
Yeah, and I think that, so we're going to talk about that actually. We won't talk about it this episode because that'll take more than just a couple minutes for us to talk about those types of things. But like whenever we start to get into our stress response and we're in it for a while, I think it's hard for us to cognitively try to pull ourselves out of it. In fact, it's that's the more difficult way of trying to do it, because not only is the thought production going up, but your brain is automatically looking for threats. And it's looking for threats even when you're thinking, right? So you can be in your stress response and trying to think of peaceful meadows and everything, and your brain is like, oh, well, what if there's a sand trap there? Or like, what if you get stung by a bee? Or, you know,
right.
whatever
yeah,
it may
it's
be.
Scanning against your will.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great things about our brain, but it's also one of the things that can really throw us for a curveball. So that being said, being able to balance your stress response with things that are real threats versus things that are really being amped up based on your experiences, right? So if I get in an accident or an intersection and I go through that intersection for the next 10 years of my life and I never have an accident, like, and I'm still have my stress response when I go through it, like, okay, like, it's time that I need to do something about it. Like, there needs to be some type of regulation, and it isn't going to happen naturally. Like, I have to take control of it. And what I mean by it isn't going to happen naturally is, like, my body isn't all of a sudden going to be like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, this is a safe place. Like,
right.
That isn't going to happen. Your body and brain are doing the best they can to keep you safe, right? And sometimes you have to kind of take the, you know, you have to take the initiative to be like, all right, this isn't true anymore. This isn't how it is. I need to help my body know that it's safe so that I can kind of help my brain realize and help
Absolutely.
Reprogram my amygdala, right? Because mm-hmm. I think that these things that we talk about or that we're going to be talking about in this next episode that we do about this is really kind of trying to retrain that amygdala, retrain the brain to be like, hey, like, this stuff is okay. It's not as big as a threat. That was a more of an isolated incident. Because the amygdala is a very much of a generalizing mm-hmm. type of thing when it's seeking threats, because it's safer a lot of time to have, for the amygdala and for your survival, to generalize things rather than have specific events. So going back to a car, right, it is more advantageous for my amygdala to be like, hey, every car is dangerous, rather than it specifically being like, oh, that car that I was driving whenever I was 16, that's the only make and model of car that's dangerous. No, the amygdala is going to be like, all cars are dangerous.
Right.
And reprogramming that is really kind of, it's really where I think a lot of our clients end up coming from. Mm-hmm. I think it's where a lot of people that have anxiety or even trauma-related issues kind of come from, where they're like, okay, like, we're done being in this stress response all the time. So I want to actually be able to talk about that, like being in the stress response constantly.
Right.
Can you kind of tell me or talk to us about some signs and symptoms of that? So if someone's listening to this and they're like, I'm wondering if this is me, like, how would they know?
I love that. So a couple of the stress responses that people would have would be that hypervigilance, noises, sounds, people coming behind them. They might jump out of their skin. They might notice muscle tension. They always have tension headaches up the back of the neck and in the shoulders. They might notice they're grimacing their face. A lot of people are grinding their teeth. They're not sleeping very well. Some of the people are noticing they can't think very well. They're not coming up with, you know, their normal thoughts that they have. Mm-hmm. They're feeling fragmented. That's a real good indicator that you're not online. You're
fragmented.
In that down.
Talk with me about that.
Yeah, fragmented thinking. So, you know, when you're anxious, you're in that downstairs brain. So you don't have as many coherent thoughts that are in mm-hmm. flow. It's more fragmented thoughts, like a piece of this, a bit of that.
Yeah, so they're not connected or
they're
anything.
They're not connected. Right.
It's like you and I are talking and I'm like, oh yeah, did I leave my oven on?
Right.
Then like later on, it's like, oh, did I feed my dogs? Then later right. on, then it's like, mm-hmm. why did I wear these shoes today?
Yeah, anxiety is a lot like people that have ADHD. It's very good mm-hmm. that you pointed that out. It's those, you know, thoughts that are not associated. They don't make sense to other people, but that worrying is constantly going. Mm-hmm. So it's that same piece. So that would be huge when you're thinking of it. We're always looking for, are they able to eat? Are they having stomach and tightening or issues with that? You know, are they in that fight state all the time? They kind of notice they're tense a lot, mm-hmm. or they're not able to do the things they used to, especially if we're looking at two or more areas of your life. Interpersonal relationship, you become irritable. You know, things that used to be able to do, you can't do them anymore. You're, mm-hmm. you're finding yourself not at your threshold is much lower than it was before. Those are some indicators. You probably need to get professional help and talk to us about how to turn down that feedback loop, how to work on some of the cognitive components, and more importantly, regulating that nervous system to try to get it back in the parasympathetic.
Yeah. So I know that we could actually probably spend a lot more time talking about this. And whenever we kind of jump into some of the specific mental health disorders, I think we'll actually be referring back to this and our stress response and everything like that. And I think that we'll be able to provide more in-depth examples. So this is just a base understanding for us to be able to kind of keep going from here. And we'll talk about different things like PTSD. We'll talk about more like acute anxiety disorders, generalized anxiety, social anxiety, all those different types of things to help kind of really hone in on those specific areas rather than just kind of provide you more of this like general outlook on things. And then, of course, I think this next episode, what we'll really be focusing on is how to kind of really take hold of the stress response and start to calm and regulate yourself so that you aren't always in the stress response. So in these cases, having professional help or having someone, maybe that's even just like another person with you that you can practice these skills with is hugely beneficial. Right, because there are times where I can lie to myself and I can sometimes do a pretty good job at tricking myself into thinking that, oh, like I'm not stressed. Right. Guess what? My wife can tell if I'm stressed every time though.
Absolutely.
Right? So sometimes our friends or family, they can pick up on that stuff, whereas we become pretty good at deceiving ourselves over time.
Yeah.
So in doing these regulation exercises, sometimes it's always good to have other people that can kind of check in on you and having other people there with you that can help support you through those types of things, because it is hard to do. It's very hard to do.
Absolutely.
But there's always potential for us to being able to do this stuff even on our own, right? So I don't want to let you like think like, oh, like I have to go and talk to someone or I have to do this in order to calm myself down. No, that's not the case. It is harder to do it that way, but it is definitely doable. And we'll talk about that during our next one, give you different skills or different techniques or anything like that. And better yet, we'll talk to you about why they work to kind of give you some insight to what's going on, you know, in your head while all this is going on. So I want to thank you guys for listening to this episode of our podcast. Thank you, Nicole, for being able to talk to us about a lot of this. I hope that you guys enjoyed listening to us, and I hope that you guys join us next time whenever we kind of talk more in depth about some of this other stuff, especially like calming ourselves down and different things that we can kind of do on our own to, you know, take hold of our own stress response. Until then, we wish you well. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.